Hi, I'm W2P Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Robert Schenken,
the playwright of not only All the Way, which was here a couple years ago, but now the, let's call it the part two, Godfather 2 of The Great Society, now at Arena Stage. Thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, I know when you wrote this thing, All the Way, this was way before it was, you know, Cranston on Broadway, and before Rob Reiner had done LBJ. I mean, your interest in reevaluating LBJ's legacy, I think kind of planted, I think you planted a seed in society for us to kind of go back and reexamine it. What was it that made you back then want to reopen that discussion? And
well, I grew up in Austin, Texas, and in the Hill Country, so not very far from where Lyndon Johnson was born and raised. So it'd be pretty hard to avoid Lyndon Johnson in my childhood, including the fact that my father knew him in a very small and fine way. My dad was a pioneer in public television and radio and had been hired to come to the University of Texas at Austin and create the first public television radio station really in the Southwest. And job number one was to go to then Senator Johnson and get his permission, because said radio television station would have been in direct conflict with his own media empire, or should I say Lady Bird's media empire.
Not to be confused with the other Lady Bird.
Because it was in her name. Pleased to say that he not only gave his permission, but of course, as president, would go on to sign into law the bill that created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So in my family growing up, he was a friend of the court. He was a good man. And my parents were both liberal Democrats, very supportive of integration. And, you know, I remember that that election, 1964, LBJ Goldwater, and how it just felt, you know, Manichaean, forces of light against the forces of dark, and how thrilled we were with this landslide victory. And then just a year and a half later, with the troop levels in Vietnam having ramped up from 23,000 to 170,000, and my oldest brother now facing the draft, I had a very different feeling about LBJ.
Was he actually drafted, or he was just the prospect
of it?
Okay.
He was not, you know, he was eligible. Fortunately, he had a high number. He drew a high number and was in college at the time. You know, that's where I sort of got off the LBJ ship. And then years later, as an artist with a young family trying to make a go of it, I became aware of the domestic programs that he had created, which were actually extremely helpful to me and people like me, people that I knew, and I thought differently about him again. So he's always been in my head as this really interesting, truly Shakespearean character, not only big physically, you know, 6'4", whatever, 250 pounds, but big emotionally, big in his appetites, big in his virtues and his vices, a Shakespearean character and someone who, it seemed to me, belonged on the stage. And if you're going to understand where we are today politically, I think you really need to understand LBJ. There are people who say, Joseph Calfano Jr., among them, that we live in the world that LBJ created. And I think there's actually some truth to that. So I, when given the opportunity on this commission by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival to actually the very first commission they offered for their American Revolutions project, I said I wanted to write about LBJ. And so began a very long process of research and reading and studying and thought, culminating in All the Way.
What all did you read? Was there a specific biography? Was there old speeches you went back and watched? I'm sure all of the above.
I read everything I could get my hands on, and there's a lot out there. Certainly every major biography about Lyndon Johnson and his own writings. Major biography on everybody, every major player in his administration who appears in the play. histories on the Vietnam War, histories on the Great Society, a fairly comprehensive – I cast a wide net. And then I also interviewed people. I talked to people who had served in his administration. I talked to family members. And then, as you say, there is a lot of footage extant from this period. Television really comes into its own as a political force. And so there's a lot of that material available, as well as this is kind of the high point in American magazines, Newsweek, Time, Look, Life. Right. Every major city had at least two newspapers, so there was a wealth of material to sort through.
In that regard, you're almost fortunate compared to if you were writing about, you know, a figure in the pre-TV era. You know, you had a wealth of sources at your disposal. Remind our listeners. Let's say they missed all the way when it was here, or they saw it, but you know, it's been a few years. Remind them, sort of, you know, how that was part one, exploring, you know, the sure. trying to, you know, I guess it's after he's been elected and trying to pass the Civil Rights Act of 64, which is what the Reiner movie was about too. But then also, and then how this is kind of sort of the part two of that, I guess, exploring the remainder of his administration, the civil rights movement's heating up. King is, you know, on a fatalistic path himself, and Vietnam is ramping up so that he doesn't even run again.
Right. So for those on your audience who missed All the Way, which won the Tony Award in 2015 and then went
several
on.
Several Tonys, right?
Multiple
Tonys.
Best actor that season as well for Bryan Cranston. And then went on to be a very successful Emmy-nominated movie at HBO. Which I also wrote, followed the first term. Jack Kennedy is assassinated in Dallas, and Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson suddenly becomes president, with a year before the next election. And the question on everybody's mind is, what does Lyndon Johnson really want? Because Lyndon Johnson has played a very close political game all his life. To liberal Democrats, he's a liberal. To the Southern Dixiecrats, he's a good old boy. But what does he really believe? And to everyone's surprise, it turns out that what Lyndon Johnson really believes in is civil rights. And so All the Way follows his pursuit of the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, which was a landmark bill, really changed the country profoundly, while he simultaneously pursues re-election and election as president in his own terms. He succeeds, but already the seeds of the looming crisis have been planted in Vietnam, as he's already begun to ramp up troop levels there and to lie to the American public about what's going on. The Great Society follows his second term, November 1964, on the heels of his historic landslide victory over Barry Goldwater, which gives him control of both houses of Congress, culminating 4 years later in his shocking public television announcement that he will not run again for office. It's the end of his career. So if you think about this in classical terms, classical theater terms, All the Way is a drama. Mm-hmm. And The Great Society is tragedy, in which this individual who inarguably does so much good domestically, Medicare, Medicaid, education, clean air, clean water, three historic civil rights bills, multiple appointments, just profound shifting of the society and Vietnam. You know, it is, he knew at the time that his foreign policy was going to doom his domestic policy, and yet he continued to march forward. And so it's so puzzling to consider that a politician so skilled, so smart, so shrewd, could not find a way out of this box. And the consequences of those decisions, of course, we live with to this day. It's really a tragic story.
It's one of those where if you had come up with it as its own two-play thing, you'd be like, oh, that's far-fetched. But its truth is really strange. Like, it writes itself in a certain way.
It's true.
You know?
And of course, there are such amazing people in this story. Dr. King, of course, who finds himself, the highlight of his long-standing career seeking justice, culminating in the 64 and 65 civil rights bills, and then the emergence of Black Power and the marginalization of the nonviolent movement. King comes out against the war in Vietnam and is demonized in, very largely across the country and even within the civil rights movement for doing so, and then is assassinated in Memphis. Bobby Kennedy, who has really finds himself finally after wandering in the political desert, seemingly in place to take the Democratic nomination, and then he also is assassinated, this time in Los Angeles. On the right, you have the shocking rise of Richard Nixon, seemingly out of the ash can of political history, and he will, of course, be elected twice to president. But this is his rise again. And in the South, George Wallace. It's an extraordinary collection of individuals, powerful people, impassioned people in really desperate conflict. It's a very dramatic, chewy stuff. Pretty exciting.
Lots to work with on your part.
lots to work with, and it makes for a really terrific evening in the theater.
Now, how long after All the Way did you begin putting pen to paper on this one? Was it always, did you always conceive it as a two-play thing?
No, or? I would have been very disappointed if I'd never been able to write what I can call a part two or the second part of this story. And fortunately, even as I was actually writing All the Way, I was commissioned by the Seattle Repertory Theater to write The Great Society. And honestly, when we won the Tony Award in New York, the next day I and my director, Bill Rausch, flying back from New York City to Ashland, Oregon, going over our notes for a Great Society run-through to be held that week. That's how tight these things were. It was a very exciting time.
Awesome. Now we kind of hit on for maybe listeners that missed it the first time, but let's say for our listeners that did come out, they're in for a treat. It's a lot of the same cast. Jack Willis is back as LBJ. Bowman Wright, who stopped into WTOP in studio last time around, and he's back as MLK. Was there ever any doubt that you'd try to cast at least most of the same people? To keep the same cast, and how? I mean, is it a no-brainer? They enjoyed it so much the first time. They say, of course, anything you need, Robert.
Well, it's such a great ensemble of actors. They're such extraordinary, talented individuals. The challenge, of course, is that they're in demand as a consequence. So you hope you can get them all back, knowing that that's a long reach. But in our case, we were extraordinarily fortunate. I think everybody really wanted to be back, and particularly in this ensemble headed by, as you say, Jack Willis, who originated the role of LBJ in both plays and is giving, I think, the performance of a lifetime. It's really amazing theater. This performance you do not want to miss.
What is it about Jack Willis's performance? Because we've seen, I mean, do a little compare contrasting. It doesn't have to be one's better than the other, but just in different styles. Let's say Cranston, who I assume he won the Tony, and so you work closely with him as well, versus Willis. Or even did you check out Woody Harrelson's portrait too? Like, kind of speak on sort of the different approaches.
I haven't seen the Woody Harrelson movie, although I'm very eager to do so. Obviously, I'm very familiar with Brian's work, which was fabulous and very justifiably honored. It's really hard to compare its apples and oranges. What I will say about Jack is that he brings a ferocity to the part and an intensity that is unrelenting. And in this part two, essentially, in The Great Society, ultimately a vulnerability that's shattering. So, Brian never got a chance to play right. The Great Society, and neither has Woody. So this is territory that Jack has really carved out on his own, and it is an extraordinary. I mean, the role is like Lear in terms of its size, what it demands of the actor. You rarely leave the stage. And the emotional demands are extraordinary. But Jack is just giving a magnificent performance. Don't miss this. If you see one thing this year, see Jack Willis in The Great Society.
That's high praise right there. How about speak to Bowman Wright a little bit? He actually, before All the Way, he played King previously here one time in a play called The Mountaintop. Then, of course, All the Way, and now he's back for I guess this is his MLK trilogy here. What have you enjoyed about watching his performance grow from the first time you did it here to now? Like, as you say, he and LBJ, MLK and LBJ were more allies in the first one, and this one there's a little more tension over the war.
No, they split completely. It's a tragic thing what happens to them. We're so fortunate to have Bowman. He's a phenomenal actor, and I have seen a number of people play this part, of course, and I think what he brings here, there's such intelligence and compassion in this role. You know, I think American audiences, if they think about Dr. King, they either think of him as the orator or the martyr. And what I have tried to do in the text here, and what Bowman so beautifully illuminates, is Dr. King, the politician. He was an extraordinary politician. If you consider the task he had in front of him, the civil rights movement was by no means a monolithic movement. It was very fractured and fractious, each group headed by a very charismatic, very powerful men who did not share power easily. And somehow Dr. King found a way for many years to keep everybody more or less working in the same direction toward the same goal. And that is the mark of a highly skilled, very talented and extraordinarily hardworking and gifted politician. And Bo just does a wonderful job with that, really bringing that to life here.
I want to know more about you. Take it all the way back. Was it Carolina you grew up? I want to know how, what theater or film or books or whatever interests you as a kid and how you got into, playwriting.
Well,
I'm a theater arts drama teacher.
I am a Tar Heel by birth, but a Texan by adoption. I grew up in Austin. I grew up and then went to school and went to college at the University of Texas. My father was a playwright, and my mother was a professional actress before they got married. So I grew up in a house full of books and full of plays, and we went to the theater. So it seemed like a very natural thing to do. I have been blessed on occasion with a really extraordinary and important teacher. I guess one of the most important to me was a Polish a professor who taught at the University of Texas from 1971 to 1975 when I was there from the National School in Warsaw. And from her, I got the best piece of advice I've ever gotten as an artist and maybe as a human being. I was an actor then, primarily, and not a bad actor at all. But my problem was I could see the performance so clearly in my head, and then I would try to be that. I'd try to make every bit of it. And it just used to drive her crazy. And I remember in one class I finished a scene and she just stood up and she said, Robert, you must leave something for God. And, you know, that's just such great advice, this notion that you cannot control everything.
Right.
On stage or off stage, and that one must make allowance. One indeed must welcome in the unanticipated, the unexpected. So I started off as an actor. I was going to be Orson Welles, act, write, and direct. The directing part never happened so much, but I did write from a very early age on. I lived in New York and Los Angeles and had a very successful career as an actor.
But you didn't have a sled as a kid, do you?
Named Rosebud. But the writing eventually began to take over, and then I wrote a play called The Kentucky Cycle, which of course went on to win the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
And the experience of that was so deeply satisfying. I thought, you know, this is really what I should be doing.
Before we go further, let's remind our listeners about that a little bit. It sort of explored American mythology, Western mythology, over a series of plays. Were you inspired by August Wilson's Pittsburgh Cycle, at least in the rollout?
This is actually, you know, August has just written two plays at that point.
It's early on in that
early
cycle,
on, and
yeah.
In fact, as an actor, I'm at the O'Neill Center when his very first play, Ma Rainey, actually gets a public staging. So he hasn't really
right.
begun to, you know, stretch,
sort of happening at the same
stretch
time.
His wings. So it's kind of happening at the same time. It is it's nine short plays comprising 6 hours, normally produced in two parts, following the journey of three fictional families in the eastern part of Kentucky from 1775 to 1975. So it's a very ambitious, epic kind of piece. As you say, a look at American myth-making.
What is it in Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend? A little bit of that?
Something like that, perhaps.
I love it. And then beyond that, obviously, we between there and all the way, you've done a lot too. But even a little screen. I mean, you mentioned Orson Welles. You've done a little screenwriting too. Hacksaw Ridge, The Pacific. What draws you to? I mean, in here we're dealing with Vietnam. What draws you to not only the subject of war, but you know, reexamining these pivotal moments in our history.
You know, I couldn't tell you the why of it, except that it pleases me. It interests me. I love history and would read it. You know, just purely for my own pleasure. I do think that it's important. I do think that history is not something that just exists in the past. It lives through us continuously. We are continuously informed by and moved by, oftentimes in ways we don't understand or not even conscious of, by history. And I think it's so important to in terms of being able to understand where we are, to understand where we've been. So
I'm with you entirely. I think the whole notion of time and past and present and future is an illusion. I think it's all happening right in front of our face. Past is prologue, and that's what's so great about Arena is we get to grapple with this,
and
it's alive, happening now.
Right.
I don't think it's something that existed in the past. You know?
And then there are such wonderful stories. Hacksaw Ridge, the true story of Desmond Doss, the first conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor. This is such an amazing story. This individual struggle of conscience and patriotism, and the way in which he manages to bring them both together, is so moving and so inspiring. So whenever I get an opportunity to tell a story like that, I'm the first one to jump on it. I enjoy writing film. I enjoy writing television. These are indeed how I pay my bills. But even if they didn't, I would still do it because of the opportunities it affords me to tell a big story in a big way, and the opportunity to work with the people I've had a chance to work with. That's I currently have a of four different movies, any one of which or all of which could go into production this year. So I'm, you know, I'm very excited about the.
Are you allowed
to
give us a little teaser?
The possibilities. Well, I have a movie about Vietnam called Fall of Saigon, which is about America's last days, literal last days in Vietnam. I have a movie I've written for Joseph Gordon-Levitt, predicated on a little-known but very compelling historical event when the 7th Cavalry threw down with the Klan in South Carolina during Reconstruction. I'm writing a movie for Bob Redford to direct about the Manhattan Project. And I'm working on a contemporary piece about high school sports in Texas.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a wide range of stories and events and people with a fantastic group of talented artists. I consider myself very, very fortunate to do what I do and to be here in Washington today on the eve of the opening of The Great Society with Jack Willis.
That's perfect. Just sort of in closing, you mentioned that TV and film sort of helps pay the bills, but then you love getting to come do stuff like this on the eve of this. What's it been like working with the folks at Arena? I mean, this is twice with this material. Had you been here working with them in the past?
You know, I've known Molly Smith for a very long time before she even arrived at Arena stage. And I have had a number of pieces read here, developed here, been commissioned by the Arena, and then now these two productions. It's always a pleasure to work at this theater. I think it's, you know, they have such a strong aesthetic, such high standards, and the people are just so pleasant to work with. Very professional, collegial group. And to do these plays about politics, about presidential politics and ongoing foreign wars at this moment of time here in Washington, D.C., in front of Washington audiences who I think are the equal of any audience in terms of sophistication anywhere in the world is a real thrill.
Absolutely. Well, if it's a thrill for you, it's a real thrill for us. So thanks so much for taking the time to join us. This was great.
Pleasure to be here.